Good evening. I am incredibly grateful for you coming out here. I don't know about you, but ever since the emergence of another COVID variant, I was kind of wondering whether anyone would turn up. And so I'm incredibly grateful that you guys would give me an evening to think about this question of anxiety. Why does this question matter to me? Well, I think I want to suggest to you it matters to me, and I think it should matter to you on at least three levels. The first of which is the macro level that Andrew just touched upon. This is undoubtedly the great social crisis of our time. One journalist, I think, put it very well when he said, anxiety has become the cultural condition of modernity. Essentially, that it's inextricably part of the air that we breathe. It's woven into what it means to live in a modern 21st century life that we all experience, or many of us experience, anxiety. It's the mood music around us, the backdrop of our lives. It's a mainstream phenomenon. One statistic that sticks out to me that really drove this home to me was, back in 2016, way before anything COVID or anything else like that, university students in the US were asked if they had experienced anxiety in the last year to the point where it had become debilitating, that it had impeded their lifestyle, that it had prevented them from being able to do their normal activities. And I don't know, maybe what you think of what the percentage would be. Maybe it would be a kind of a significant minority, 20, 30%, something like that. Well, according to one study, it was nearly 60%. A majority of college students in the last year, this is way before COVID, had experienced anxiety to the point where it stopped them being able to do their normal lives. This is undoubtedly a mainstream phenomenon. And so the million-dollar question is why? And I was really excited to immerse myself in this topic and think about this over the last little while to try and unpick and understand what's driving this. That's the first reason. The second of which is the kind of more micro. If that was the macro, the micro reason is, as Andrew mentioned, I'm a pastor. I help to lead a community of somewhere between 200 to 250 young adults who meet here for church on Sunday. And I've seen firsthand the pain that comes with the reality of anxiety. The physical symptoms, whether that's a sleeplessness or stomach cramps or days off work. But perhaps more perniciously, more worryingly, the social effects of anxiety, the way it paralyzes folk, causes them to withdraw from community. Perhaps even worse than that, the sense of stigma, the internal frustration that accompanies anxiety, that people will say to themselves, why am I feeling this? Why? Essentially, a frustration with a felt sense of weakness. Why am I being troubled by these thoughts? Why are these thoughts stopping me from being able to do what I want to do? And with that, I think, an experience of shame. And so many of us are asking, if this is our personal experience, we're asking, how can I resolve this? And if it's almost certainly the case that we will know people who struggle with anxiety, and you may be asking with me the question, how can I help those who I love? What are the answers that we can give to those who struggle with anxiety? Because this problem feels very hard to solve. So the macro, the micro, and the third reason that this really matters to me is spiritually. I guess I want to show you this evening, as we unpack the question of anxiety, how the Christian faith connects with our deepest longings. Now, I don't come from a Christian background. I grew up in a Jewish atheist family. I became a Christian when I was at university about 14 years ago. And really, at the time, I became a Christian because I was convinced that it was true, that there really was a man called Jesus Christ, and he wasn't simply a good teacher who came up with some ideas that would change Western civilization, but he was who he said he was, God in the flesh. But it's more than whether it's true or false. I want to argue, in a sense tonight, that Christianity is true to life. That it's true to the human experience. It's true not because it's historically happened, but because it connects with our deepest desires. It makes sense of life. It explains our experience of anxiety, the underlying sense of vulnerability and uncertainty that I think drives our anxiety. And I would argue it's the best answer to this contemporary epidemic. So let's step back then and first start by defining what is anxiety. Because as you're probably aware, it's something of a catch-all term. I would suggest there's at least perhaps three different ways of understanding anxiety. The first is the pervasive sense of worry that accompanies all of life. The sense that whether they're big or small items, the sense that worry becomes the kind of underlying feeling of your life. Scott Stossel, who is an editor of a New York Times magazine, wrote what I think is one of the best popular treatments of anxiety, called My Age of Anxiety. And this is how he describes the condition. He's someone who suffered for many years. It's a really tragic story, but a fascinating one. He says, "I am buffeted by worry about my health and my family members' health, about finances, about works, about the rattle in my car, about the dripping in my basement, about the encroachment of old age, about the inevitability of death, about everything and nothing." If you've experienced anxiety, you know what he's talking about. The way how it can take hold of the most mundane thing and how a worry can affect and then eat away at you, or sometimes worry about the very biggest things. I think really it's a generalized sense of uncertainty, an intuitive sense of your vulnerability. The feeling, the question which lurks underneath, which says, what misfortune lurks around the corner that I might encounter next? Sometimes we think, what is fear and what is anxiety? Well, I think fear is a very concrete thing. I'm scared of that saber-toothed tiger or that car or whatever it is that... Saber-toothed tigers, they're prehistoric, right? So you're probably unlikely to encounter that. But that thing, I'm scared of that concrete thing. That's what fear is. Anxiety is more about a kind of generalized sense of fear. The sense of maybe you had a car coming at you and at that moment you felt fear. But as the car drove away and missed you narrowly, you just feel a little bit more vulnerable, a little bit more sense of I'm in danger. And I think that is what anxiety is. So that's the kind of generalized sense. I also think there's very specific fears that often underlie anxiety. And often those fears actually reveal what you value most. I think the most obvious one of these is health anxiety. It's something that I've met in a number of different people. And you'll know if this is something you experience. I think I experience it to some level. You know, maybe you're shaving and you come across a pimple or something on your skin. And immediately you take a picture and you go on Dr. Google and you spend a little bit of time. I haven't done this. I'll tell you about mine in a moment. But, you know, you go on Dr. Google and after half an hour, you're convinced you've got skin cancer. And you're off to the doctor. And... you know, I think I've definitely had like a small pain in my side and I thought, maybe I have stomach cancer. That's genuinely my first thought in that moment. Fortunately, I have a wife who's a nurse who is used to my many questions. I think my health anxiety is also combined with hypochondria and also a love of drama in my life. And therefore, together, it's kind of a toxic cocktail that means I'm just delighting in any newfangled illness. I'm actually a pretty well guy most of the time, but I just kind of... almost enjoy health anxiety. So probably if you have health anxiety, it's not that experience, but you know what I mean. The sense of rabbit warren that your thoughts can go down as you start to speculate on the health or the lack of health, that fear of sickness, the fear of suffering that comes with it, the fear of old age. I've definitely encountered that in some, and perhaps behind all of it, the fear of death. There's health anxiety, there's financial anxiety, the worry about loss of finances, whether I'll have enough, relationship anxiety, the fear of whether I'll be alone. And I think if you listen to those fears, you'll likely tell you what you value most. And then I think the final part of anxiety that I would define is people anxiety. This is a very broad understand topic, but I think underneath it, you will recognize, you have some familiarity with this. We see this with social anxiety. The fact that when some of you come into a room of random people, underneath you start to feel a little bit anxious. You're really asking the question, what will people think of me? Will I belong? Perhaps it causes you to clam up. I think it can be often a vicious cycle that those who experience social anxiety withdraw, and then actually that creates more anxiety, more fear of people. I think there's also performance anxiety. As you're doing your work in the office or perhaps at home, you're thinking, what will people make of my performance? Or perhaps a sense of imposter syndrome. When will people find out that I'm really just not very good at my job? Or specific events, whether it's public speaking or a specific moment at work or specific people where you know that their opinion of you is, it kind of hangs over them. They represent judgment that will define you and can potentially crush you. And finally, I think there's a kind of sense of status anxiety. Now, this doesn't sound, you know, the kind of obsession with financial rewards or opposition at work or even the size of our pay packet. Really, what I think society describes as a level of status. And even this, I think, is an anxiety about people. Really, underlying that status anxiety is, will people respect me? Will people love me? The secular philosopher and author, Alain de Botton, wrote a book called Status Anxiety. And in it, he tracks our concerns and fears about our promotions and our jobs and everything else like that back to the internal sense of whether I'm loved. He says, once food and shelter have been secured, the predominant impulse behind our desire to succeed in the social hierarchy may not lie so much with the goods we can accrue or the power we can wield as with the amount of love we can stand to receive as a consequence of high status. Money, fame, and influence may be valued more as tokens and as means to love rather than ends in themselves. Saying we become anxious about our pay and our position because they represent some sense of approval, some sense of even love from the crowd, from the peers, from the people we work with. I think the central question that hangs behind all these different forms of people anxiety is the question, will I be loved? Will I be respected? That, I think, is the great longing of the human heart. And then that is why the fear arises within us that that won't happen. So put all of these together, and I think then the only thing that we add to that is the kind of sense of anxiety about anxiousness. As the anxiety bubbles up, as it's reported again and again in the news, we then become anxious about being anxious. Or maybe you've experienced anxiety, and you know the kind of cost of that experience in your life, and so you think, I don't want that to happen again. There's a contagious element to this. There's part of our motor neurons that we actually reflect the mood of the people around us. And so sometimes if you're someone who struggles with anxiety, you don't want to be around other people who experience anxiety. So then we have to ask, is this a modern phenomenon? Is this a kind of extra thing that we're experiencing now more than before? And I think I would answer the answer yes and no. First of all, yes. There's no question that there's a feeling in our society that anxiety is rising. About 67% of us would suggest that we are more anxious as a society. Just over a third of us would say that we personally feel more anxious than we were before. And it would come no surprise to you that this is particularly in London, which is the region in the UK which experiences the highest level of anxiety. And about one third of us will experience anxiety, a recognized medical anxiety disorder in our lives. And many more will experience it on a kind of more superficial level, a kind of sense of general fears of the future or whatever. And this trend seems to be particularly pronounced in Gen Z and millennials. So why do we see this data, this sense of rise and growth in our culture? Well, there are lots you could say about this. There's all sorts of different things that economists or psychologists, philosophers have attempted to try and explain this trend in anxiety. I would suggest that there are three big ones that I would want to look at that I think are really fascinating. The first one is our changing habits around technology, around social media. This has been referenced a number of times, but in broadly speaking, one clinical psychologist, a lady called Jean Twenge, essentially looked at all the data and found that in 2012 in the US, there was something of an inflection point, something of a dramatic change at the level of anxiety that teens and young people were experiencing. And she said she correlates this moment of change with the moment that iPhones became universal. And with the iPhone came a transformed world. It transformed how we socially interact. It transformed our mental health, such that she asks, or she suggests, from all her data and research, and she's written a couple of books on this subject, the iGen, which is those born after 1995, those who essentially grew up with this technology as standard, she describes them as being on the brink of the worst mental health crisis in decades. And there are all sorts of different causal reasons. But before we go into this, one more fascinating study that will bear this out. You may have heard of a man called Cal Newport. He's a writer on digital minimalism, on reducing the kind of influence of digital screens in our lives. And he referenced a study last month, I think it was either September or October, which, absolutely fascinating. A bunch of psychologists from MIT and Stanford went back to the mental health data that they could find of the universities in the US as Facebook was launched. As you may or may not be aware, Facebook launched in a staggered way. So they could literally, it was a kind of what they described as a kind of natural experiment, that as they could go back and say, well, when Facebook went to that campus, what was the mental state of mental health, and watch it as it grew. And what they identified was the negative effect of Facebook, such that it was about one-fifth of the effect of losing your job. One-fifth of the effect of losing your job, that they saw that negative effect on depression and anxiety as a result of Facebook and then everything else that followed from that coming to that campus. And in a couple of these books, Gene Twenge then goes on to unpack what are the different drivers. Why is social media so toxic for our mental health? Why does it drive anxiety? Well, the first one, I think, is that social media accentuates or speaks directly to that deep sense of performance anxiety in us. That sense of you're encouraged to curate and produce the best version of yourself, to put it on display so that you can receive some level of performance review, some level of likes or responses in your friends. It speaks to that great question which lingers in all our minds. Will people love me? Will people respect me? Will people approve of me? Jonathan Haidt, interestingly, an American psychologist, said this effect actually affects teenage girls more than teenage boys. That right from a young age, he put it in general terms a couple of weeks ago, he said teenage girls have an instinct to perform, teenage boys have an instinct to play. And actually, insofar as girls have higher social media usage and that they are more liable to fall to be a victim of the way social media perpetuates a kind of comparison and a performance mindset, comparing standard of beauty in all sorts of other ways before we even get into filters and all sorts of other things. It also, another factor here is that social media reduces social interaction, it reduces the level of quality interaction that you have with the people around you. So actually social media leads to increased feelings of loneliness. It accentuates that feeling of the fear of missing out, as you literally can see all the things that other people are doing that make you anxious and worried about not being involved in those things and essentially not being included. There's online bullying, there's reduced sleep. There's enough to make most people want to quit social media. That's the first thing that I think is fascinating. The second one of these is the changing worldview, and what I would describe as individualism. The biggest change over the last 100 years, I would argue, is the way we have gone from quite a communal society where we've viewed ourselves as part of a group, whether it's our nation or our community or our family, and this is true in the West, certainly, and where we've understood our role as kind of fulfilling a function in the group in some way, and we've shifted to a profound emphasis on individual self-fulfillment and individual happiness. Now, that's not an innocuous or bad thing in and of itself. I don't think it's a terrible thing in and of itself, but actually has a number of different unforeseen consequences. The first of which, it puts a great pressure on the individual to achieve and to find their own source of meaning and purpose. It sounds intuitively compelling, but actually that experience can be crushing as you go from job to job and opportunity to opportunity saying, I need to find my raison d'etre, I need to find my reason for being. Actually, the Danish philosopher described anxiety as the dizziness of freedom. We're a society that has embraced freedom, embraced as much choice as possible, but with that freedom actually comes a dizziness, a kind of anxiety of, will I make the optimal choice? Will I maximize my happiness? Have I found the thing that will define my life? I think there's also a great clash of expectations and reality. Those of millennials and Gen Z were raised with the idea, you can be anything you want to be. And we dreamt of changing the world, of reaching the top of our career, of finding the one, that person, and leaving a dent in the world. In reality, things were much harder than they looked. Even just simply doing adult life, adulting, was a lot harder than we realized, let alone changing the world and doing anything else that we dreamt of. So there's a great clash of expectations and reality. The final thing about individualism that's so toxic is, in the pursuit of our individual freedom, our individual happiness, and our own dreams, we become disconnected from our communities. Actually, you'll see that in London, you see it in our church. All sorts of people have left where they're from and have come to the big city to pursue their dreams. It's not, again, wrong in and of itself, but it means that individuals are wrenched from the community structures, from the friends and family and the people around them they need to support them. And anyone who's experienced anxiety knows that anxiety flourishes in isolation. That it's in your head. It grows and multiplies without the absence of other voices coming in with calm and comforting words. So that I think individualism breeds isolation, which only leads anxiety to flourish. And finally, I think there's just changing circumstances. We are experiencing a toxic cocktail of different really what I would describe as a kind of perpetual narrative of collective threats, a kind of new sources of doom in the news media that just cause a great sense of anxiety. Obviously, COVID, most obvious, kind of daily tremors, and new feeds our health anxiety and our isolation. One report suggested about 26% increase in anxiety disorders globally over the last year and a half, over the pandemic. One that I think is fascinating, and you may relate to this, is eco-anxiety. Eco-anxiety, the prospect of an environmental catastrophe and how that affects our mental health. One study of clinical psychologists in the UK said they have seen, I think it was 56% of clinical psychologists have met children, in their work, have met children who are growing up anxious, about stressed about the climate crisis. My three-year-old son has two books on the world. Well, I think we bought them, or someone else bought them for us. And both of them actually really have this kind of underlying drumbeat of the world is being destroyed and you should be worried about this. And actually, I think that's kind of toxic. I'm not suggesting there isn't a climate crisis. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't be aware of it and respond to it. But if you raise children with this great sense of eco-anxiety, I don't actually know if that's necessarily the best thing for them. Actually, if anything, you should probably raise them with a love of the world that we're in, such they want to cultivate it. And then there's economic security, insecurity, austerity, the fact that we're growing up with all the normal markers of stability and security that previous generations look to, buying your own home, being married, having kids, all those things feel further out of reach and perhaps impossible to us. So I think there are a number of short-term aggravating factors that you really can pit to and say, I can see why anxiety is rising. But I don't think that's enough. In fact, one thing we should say is I think we just live in a culture that's more ready to talk about anxiety. I don't think it's simply that we are more anxious. I think part of the reality is we're more ready to talk about it. But actually, I'd go even further than that and say anxiety is part of the natural human condition. You could get rid of your mobile phone. You could find all those markers of security and stability, get married, have kids. You could join a community. You could transform your personal wealth. You've got no financial anxiety in one sense. Establish a more measured set of expectations. And I think you would still be anxious. The reason is because I think anxiety is an inevitable part of the human condition. The human propensity to fear is actually a defining part of what differentiates the human from animals. You know, no other creature on the planet can feel anxiety about something they can't see. Yes, they might have an immediate fear response to a threat or a predator, but only humans can feel anxious, for example, about their own mortality. It connects with our deepest wiring. It's actually a reflection of the fact that there's part of us that has a good wiring that when we see something dangerous, we have a fight or flight response. Actually, anxiety speaks to the most fundamental reality of the human condition. And I think it tells us something about what it means to be human. First of all, you've got to see is that anxiety is not a modern phenomenon. A number of generations have been using or speaking with the rhetoric that anxiety is higher than it ever has been before. The fact that we're saying that now, they've been saying it for the last 200 years. In 1948, W.H. Auden wrote this Pulitzer Prize-winning poem called "This Age of Anxiety." capturing what if the increased sense of anxiety in the industrial age, in post-war society, long before mobile phones and social media and the destruction of traditional community structures. Even in 1838, the doctor Edwin Lee in the UK said, "Nervous complaints prevail at the present day to an extent unknown at any former period or in any other nation." Essentially, we've been saying this forever. If you go back through history and you'll see all sorts of different figures who struggle with anxiety. Charles Darwin, after his voyage on the Beagle, was housebound by anxiety. He had to try and go to different spas, and at one point, kind of an extensive ice bath, all ways of dealing with his agoraphobia and sense of anxiety. Isaac Newton, who invented calculus, it was apparently, according to one account, there was a period of about 10 years from when he invented it to when everybody else found out about it, because he didn't actually bring it to the world, partly because of his anxiety and depression and his agoraphobia. Even Demosthenes, the great Greek orator, who's kind of looked upon as the father of public speaking, experienced panic attacks, vomiting before speaking in public. Anxiety has worked its way out in every culture. I love this. The Inuit people of Greenland have a word for kayak anxiety, which is the unwillingness to go seal hunting on your own. I just love that. That's just so emblematic of the fact that every culture will experience anxiety, and it will manifest itself in different ways according to the age and the circumstances that you live in. Or Hippocrates, I don't know how to say his name, the doctor who established, who we get the Hippocratic Oath from, writing in the 4th century BC, so nearly 2,500 years ago, describes anxiety in his famous book, Disease on Disease, as a mental complaint that brings about nausea. Plus ça change. The things don't just keep on. We've experienced this for hundreds and thousands of years. Even then, in the Greek society, they were having a debate. Is this just a mental, philosophical problem, a faulty logic, or is this a biological problem? Are there underlying biological reasons? Ultimately, the drivers of anxiety are universal. We may react differently according to our wiring, our genetics, perhaps even our life experience. But I would argue there are underlying factors that make anxiety an inevitable part of the human experience. I want to give you three. The first one is human vulnerability, the strong likelihood of suffering. It's not simply the uncertainty that drives anxiety. Fear and anxiety are ultimately a response to the very real prospect of future suffering. The fundamental reality, you might say a very high probability, but pretty much the certainty that at some point in your life, you will suffer. Shakespeare put it very well in Macbeth, "Each new morn, new widows howl, new orphans cry, new sorrows strike heaven on the face." Anxiety is that feeling in the gut that we will confront pain. It's a visceral response to the future pain that we, in some sense, know we will experience in life. In fact, if you're to face life rightly, even if anxiety isn't our experience, we need to learn to live with the prospect of future suffering. Ernst Becker, the psychologist, said, "To live fully is to live with an awareness of the rumble of terror that underlies everything." In some way, what I'm trying to say is, if you experience anxiety, you perhaps have actually got a better view of the reality of suffering than perhaps others. They're just kind of naively going around life, just kind of saying, everything's fine. Perhaps actually, if you experience anxiety, you actually have a window into reality, that suffering is part of the human condition. We're more vulnerable than we'd care to admit. And this is why we want to have control. This is why we want to give ourselves a veneer of control, because we're trying to minimize future suffering. We're trying to find some way of telling ourselves that we are able to manage our lives to eliminate suffering. The reality is we can't. By the way, I think that's why money is so tempting, why it's often the thing that we look for, because money gives you the illusion of control, the veneer that you can somehow eliminate suffering from your life. But whether it's disease, relationship breakdown, whether it's your child growing up and rejecting you, many of life's tragedies cannot be eliminated by having lots of money. So that's the first reason that anxiety is inevitable. The second reason is unmet desire. You will not get what you want. You are anxious because you know that the things you long for will not be fulfilled. the things we've built our happiness on, the things we believe are essential to our flourishing, are fundamentally uncertain. We don't know whether we'll have them. And so, as a result, we experience anxiety. We know that disappointment and loss are inevitable. We've experienced that before. You're anxious about your performance because you know it's possible that you might fail. You're anxious about your relationship ending because you know you've experienced rejection before. Barry Wolf, one psychiatrist, described the pain that comes from unmet desires. He described meeting a concert pianist, a guy who trained all his life to be a concert pianist. And when he was at university, his professors told him he wasn't talented enough to achieve his dream. And he became beset by terrible panic attacks. And this psychiatrist said that pain was essentially a symptom of the underlying existential loss. The very thing that he'd dreamt of, the thing that he decided was an essential part of who he was ripped away from him. And so he became anxious. And we will be anxious because we know not all our desires will be fulfilled. And so you know that, you can see this is one of the reasons for anxiety, because many of the answers to anxiety are around trying to reduce your desire, trying to eliminate your desire. Mindfulness, meditation is actually often an exercise in trying to still those desires within you so you actually don't feel desire. Of course, I don't think it's really lasting enough. It doesn't deal with your desires sufficiently. But it's interesting that they seek to detach from desire because they see that desire, the Eastern school of thought at least, sees that desire leads to frustration and anxiety. But I think the ultimate reason for anxiety, or one of the big ones, is death. The ultimate cause for anxiety and terror is the fear of death. It's uncomfortable even to consider our fear of extinction, to reckon with that there's going to be a point in human history when your loved ones will hold on to your cold, dead hands. It's kind of brutal, but I just had an out-of-body experience recently where I was just reflecting, thinking there will be that moment when my family, hopefully my family, will be around my deathbed and I will say goodbye to them. Our fear of our insignificance, a day when when barely anyone will know who you are. This fear of death manifests itself in all sorts of ways. Ernst Becker, that psychologist, said, "The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It is the mainspring of human anxiety. Activity largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny for man." He's saying there's all sorts of activity, all sorts of things we do to try and stave off the grim reality of our mortality. Whether it be that kind of attempt to try and wring out of life all of the enjoyment that we could get out of it, or maybe even the attempt to try and establish a legacy for ourselves and build something that we will be remembered in human history. Or perhaps we see it behind our health anxieties. This fear of death looms behind many of our anxieties. So put these things together and we're more vulnerable than we'd like to admit. We cannot control the future. We will inevitably be disappointed and one day will be forgotten. That is enough to induce terror in anyone. And at this point, you're probably thinking, why did I come here? Like, I see that anxiety is real and I should feel anxiety. I thought you were meant to solve the problem. Well, let me tell you, how will you bear with the fragility, the vulnerability, and the disappointment of life? Because I think that is the question. Anxiety is not so much a question of how will we expunge this? How will we remove it from our lives? The question is, how will you live rightly in the to face these great realities of life head on? That is the challenge that anxiety lays before us. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard said, "He, therefore, who has learned rightly to be in anxiety has learned the most important thing." How do we live rightly with the reality of our own vulnerability and our fragility in light of our anxiety? Or I would argue that much of the contemporary answers to this question only deal with it at the thought management level. They're almost ways of just trying to train your mind to feel a little bit more positive about the future. Some of them are totally counterintuitive, and we can discuss them in the Q&A. Some of them make no sense to me at all. Some of them are just attempts to distract yourselves from this underlying ontological reality that I've described. I think what is required is a fundamentally different view of reality. And for that, I would suggest you must turn to the Christian faith. We need to listen to our anxiety. What about if our anxiety is telling us that we're vulnerable and fundamentally dependent creatures? What about if it's telling us something about our spiritual condition, that we cannot live rightly in this world without a conscious awareness of a God who loves for us and cares for us and is crucially in control? What about if your anxiety is actually a gift? What about if your anxiety is actually a gift that exposes your need for the God who made you? What about if our anxiety is a symptom of an even bigger problem, what I would describe as cosmic insecurity? We live in a society that has detached itself from the Christian notion of a personal God. And I think this detachment can explain some of our anxiety. And I think it really, the real problem with it is we're missing the intended comfort, the lasting antidote to the inevitable human experience of fear. You see, secular philosophers have documented the existential anxiety that we experience without God. It's really interesting. Two secular philosophers in 2019 in the States, Greg Caruso and Owen Flanagan, wrote Meaning, Morals, and Purpose in the Age of Neuroscience. And essentially what they argue is the default naturalism, the idea that there is no God, there's no meaning to your life, that you have no fundamental purpose, that essentially you are just a clump of cells, that you are just your body, there's no idea, no sense of a soul, no sense that you are made by God. That is a fundamentally anxiety-inducing condition. They describe this as neuroexistentialism. And one behavioral scientist put it like this: in order to keep existential anxiety at bay, we must find and maintain perceptions of our lives as meaningful. We are a species that strives not just for survival, but also for significance. We want lives that matter. It is when people are not able to maintain meaning that they are most psychologically vulnerable. What he's saying essentially is when we have the worldview that is presented to us from an atheist perspective, that you have no fundamental meaning, that you are just that clump of cells, that is a fundamentally anxiety-inducing condition. And we can't bear with that reality. We're thrashing about for some sense of meaning and purpose to attach ourselves to, some cause, something to validate our existence. To detach ourselves from God is to create the context for despair and anxiety to flourish. But more than that, we've detached ourselves from the God who created us and intended himself to be the answer to that longing, that the answer to our longing for peace in the midst of anxiety. The Christian worldview is not presenting a set of techniques. It's a fundamental different view of reality. And I want you, if you're not a Christian, to suspend disbelief for a moment and ask yourself, how would you feel if this vision of reality was true? I want to suggest to you a few different things that the Christian faith says. The first thing it says is you are a created being, that you're loved and cared for by your heavenly Father who is in control. You're not a clump of cells. You're a person made by God, the creator of the universe who loves you and has a purpose for your life. Made you to be in a relationship with him. The first thing you need to know is that he intends you to experience his love. He made you to know him and to be in relationship with him. That's why he called himself a father. He's saying, I am the perfect father. He gives this picture. At one point, Jesus gives this picture of what that father word means when he describes the story of a son who runs away from his father, who dishonors the family, who rejects him, and then comes back kind of expecting that maybe his father will give him a place in that in the family business. But instead, the father runs out to meet him and embraces him and loves him, forgives him, and connects back with him as his father. Much more than a power or a force, the Christian understanding of a God is a father who cares for his children and is fundamentally in control. That means he expects his creatures to experience vulnerability. He expects them to live in dependence on him. He expects them to experience the fragility of life and to come running to him. He expects them to fear. That's why the most frequent command of the Bible is not don't commit adultery, it's do not fear. And when you hear that phrase, that word, do not fear, it's not a harsh rebuke. Why are you fearing? But you better add some religious anxiety to your existing anxiety. No, it's like a father who invites his child, who gathers up his young child and says, don't worry, don't fear, I'm here. That is the feeling, that is the great antidote to the experience of anxiety that we are all longing for. He expected that his people, his creation, will be comforted by the knowledge that he will provide for them, that he loves them. A sense that as he clothes the lilies of the field, as he makes the grass grow, as he provides for the birds, he so too will provide and care for his children. He will provide everything we need. Not everything we want, but everything we need. Doesn't mean we won't suffer. Doesn't mean that we suddenly terror and the rumble of terror is not part of our existence. But we know that whatever happens, whatever anxiety, suffering might befall us, we know that we have a God who cares for us and loves us and will protect us. And this speaks to the day-to-day anxieties of life. My family had some bereavements a few years ago at birth. My brother lost twins at birth. And ever since then, pregnancy has always been an anxious experience for me, if I'm honest. And we've had two children arrive safely. My wife is pregnant with our third child. And she had the 20-week scan, but I couldn't be there for various reasons yesterday. And so I'm messaging her when I know the scan is on, and she doesn't respond. And 10, 20, 30 minutes go by, and send another message, another missed call, and still no response. And basically, after 40 minutes, I've decided that there must be something seriously wrong with the child, and possibly they're dead. And this is just because of my background and what I've experienced, but the anxiety, you know, definitely, I'm thinking, what can I do? And at that moment, even though my anxiety is ridiculous, if you think about it, she hasn't responded to a message for half an hour, it's stupid, some might say, the prospect that actually whatever happens, I said to God, you know, whatever happens, I know that you will lead us through this suffering. I know that we can face any situation because you are our Father in heaven and you will lead and comfort us. Actually, the baby's fine, everything's good. But my point is that he speaks even to the most ridiculous anxieties that we experience because we learn to trust him. You know this intuitively brings comfort. You watch a small child when they're experiencing anxiety and fear. It's not a system they need. It's not even like, fact, don't worry, you three-year-old, it's okay. Don't you realize the dark won't get you? There's no monsters. No, what they need is the presence of their father. So what they need is the presence of their parent who loves them. That is the thing that brings comfort, and that is the longing of the human heart. I think that's why we long for this, even if we don't believe in it. Julian Barnes, the atheist writer, said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. It's this longing for the comfort of a father that is behind that. The great irony is we long for the comfort that God provides, but actually as a society we rejected the idea of God because we wanted freedom. We wanted to be in control. We wanted to achieve our own destiny. And in doing so, we disconnected from the loving care of our Heavenly Father. And actually, we didn't realize that by disconnecting from his loving care, we would make life unlivable. The second layer to this is there's a relationship. We are invited into a relationship with the living God, that we experience a love from him. This is the central project of the Christian faith. The reason why Christ came to earth is to invite us into a relationship. And as we experience his love in that relationship, his love that drove him to lay down his life for us, that drove him to humiliate himself on a cross, as we experience that love reorders our desires. It means even as we experience loss, even as we experience the things that that would say, I really want that thing, but even as we lose that thing, even as we face the prospect of not meet our desires, not being met, because we have that love, we're able to bear with all sorts of suffering that comes to us. The businessman who loses his whole company and his livelihood might grieve, but is able to say through gritted teeth, I have Christ, he is enough. Or the wife who loses her husband to ill health and premature death can grieve the loss, but know that Christ's love will be her greatest comfort. And as we experience that love, we're liberated from that performance anxiety that I mentioned. You see, I mentioned before that there's a fundamental quest for love in each one of us. Alain de Botton said, our ego or self-conception could be pictured like a helium balloon of external love to remain in, a helium balloon forever requiring the helium of external love to remain inflated. And as Christians, we found a love that enables us to be inflated perpetually. That even if we fail, even if we're rejected by the crowd, that the people around us think we're an idiot, we have a love that is better than life. It means we're liberated from performance anxiety. We're liberated from the great fear of what do people think of me, because we're no longer living for the audience of the crowd and what they think. We're living for the audience of one. And finally, Christians are liberated from the fear of death. The hope that speaks to that lingering fear that says, will everything be okay? Christians live with the hope of eternal life. This is founded on the historical reality of Christ's resurrection. It says that because Christ came back from the dead, we can trust that we too will come back from the dead, that we will rise one day when Christ comes back. And that great lingering fear of death, that great enemy that plagues society, no longer plagues the Christian. The great enemy of death has been conquered. So take these all together and you see that the Christian faces the same ontological realities, but has a fundamental different new perspective. They do not fear suffering because they have a father who cares for them. They do not fear loss because they have a relationship which is far better. They do not fear the judgment of men or women because they have found the love of God. And they do not fear death because they know they will live for eternity with God. This, I believe, is the lasting antidote for anxiety. But I just want to say one thing. You may then ask me, did you just make up this God to make yourself feel better? Because if you are asking that question, you're on the right track. I want to say that. If that's the question you're asking, because you've understood my first premise and my last premise, don't worry. that this connects with our deepest longings. That this vision of God answers the deepest anxieties and longings for peace in the human heart. J.R. Tolkien said this, "There is no tale that men would ever find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits." There's no tale that men would rather was true. That's all I've been able to try and present to you tonight. Saying, I'm saying, this connects with our deepest anxieties and our longings for peace. This is the antidote I think our society is looking for, quite frankly. But there's a second half. He said, "And none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits." I'm a Christian ultimately not because it's the answer to the deepest longings of my heart, but because I'm convinced it's true. From whether it's the story of the disciples who were transformed after the resurrection, the way Christianity exploded against the odds, whilst it was an illegal cult, the miraculous testimony then and now, the experience of Christ transforming me, whether that convinces you or not, it probably won't after 30 seconds, I would at least challenge you that you must consider this question. Was this Jesus Christ just a wandering Jewish teacher who came across some truths that would answer or claim to answer the deepest longings of our heart? Or was he who he said he was, God in the flesh? Given that I think this is the answer to the anxieties we're experiencing, given that it explains the reason why we are longing for love, because we're made for a relationship with a God who loves us, given that it speaks to our deepest longings, I don't think you can leave that question unanswered. I think everybody must wrestle and ask, who was this man? If it's true, we found the source of hope, meaning, truth, love, and peace. And if it's not, well, you can ignore everything I've said for the last 45 minutes. I've left a lot unanswered, but that's why we've hopefully got time for Q&A. Thank you very much. I think we're going to take a short break. Thanks.